all the hackers and the crackers. To the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RANs, ZIPs, SIPs. Dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Hello everyone and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 79. Today is Tuesday, January 18th, 2005. I am Stank Dog, and I am joined this week, rejoined, I guess I should say, by a returning host of ours. Decius is back on the show. Welcome to you, my friend.
Thank you very much.
And we have got some very, very deep stuff coming up in the show with Decius. So before we do that, we're going to go with the housekeeping like we always do, and actually welcome a lot of new listeners that we've picked up lately. We've picked up quite a few listeners from iPodding. People are finding us on the iPod directories, and we were listed on quite a few. I went out and have put the show on a couple sites here and there, and they propagate, which is interesting. I've only ever added it to one or two, yet I find us on dozens of them, so that's interesting. But to all of you who are picking us up for the first time on your podcast, welcome to you, and you are welcome to listen to the show, and hopefully if you like it, you'll go back and listen to some of the back issues. And for those new listeners, and actually for some of the some of our older listeners might not know a little bit of this history, I thought I'd go through a quick history of Binary Revolution Radio, because the thing is, we've been doing Binary Revolution Radio for close to 2 years now. I mean, this is episode 79, a weekly show, so we're getting up there. We're a year and a half plus, and before Binary Revolution Radio even, I was fortunate enough to be involved with another hacking freaking show called Radio Freak America, and I know some of our listeners have been there through all of that as well. So Radio Freak America with Dual Parallel, Rax, Bland Inquisitor, a bunch of other great guys, and that show also lasted a couple years. They went through 99 episodes, so that's right at 2 years. So we've been doing this for quite a while. Podcasting, you know, is a fairly recent phenomenon, and it is great. It's a great medium distribution. I like it a lot. You still, if you're finding this show interesting, you might want to go back and check out some of the back episodes, past episodes, reruns, whatever you want to call them. And for RFA, for example, you want to go to oldschoolfreak.com, and you can. That's linked from binrev.com, which is our main site. Binary Revolution is binrev.com, binrev.com. And you'll find, like I said, the old episodes of Radio Freak America, as well as past episodes of Binary Revolution Radio. So if you do enjoy it, please go back and check it out. And actually, with RFA, with Radio Freak America, we're going to be launching a new podcast. Even though the show is finished with episode 99 last year, or a year or so ago, we're going to start a new podcast starting back with episode 1 because the shows are still very timely, very up-to-date, still talk about a lot of things that are very important. So we're going to probably be starting a new podcast from episode 1 and rerunning that start to finish again. So that's something that I'm looking forward to, and we'll be putting that on Hack Radio. And for those of you who don't know, Binary Revolution Radio itself, we started streaming on a station called Rant Radio, which is rantradio.com, which is up in Canada. And we've been on there since our very first episode, and we still stream there to this day every Tuesday night, 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific, I believe. Is that right? Yeah. And we also have a new hacking radio station. So if you found this because you were looking for technology, talk on tech and hacking and freaking and related topics, we have a radio station called DDP Hack Radio. It's all hacking, all the time. It's also available, it's on binrev.com, and you'll see the link right on the front page and on all of the pages that you can tune in and listen. And it has Binary Revolution Radio at the time I mentioned earlier, as well as lots of other shows that are on the schedule. And you can go to, again, radio.binrev.com specifically, and you can click on schedule to see all the different scheduled shows that are on there. We have shows that come on each night that are scheduled, so you can come home, and if you're playing on the computer, you can listen to this stuff when they air for the first time at night, in the evening is when most of the programming is. Or the other cool thing is that if you're like me, I code by day. I'm a programmer by day, so I'll go into headphones at work and want something to listen to stimulate my mind and, you know, think about things at work. So we have a fallback rotation on DDP Hack Radio that has all of the latest episodes of all of these shows. So if you did not catch it when it aired the first time, a lot of them get put into the fallback rotation. So while you're at work, you can listen to a random mix of recent hacking shows. So it's a lot of good information, and it's something that I've had always wanted before. So being that it wasn't out there, we made it happen. So if you're listening to Binary Revolution Radio and found us because you're interested in hacking and hacking information, check it out, radio.binrev.com, and again, you'll find all that information there. So that's basically a short history, probably not short enough for some, but that was a short history. So if you're joining us through the podcast, I hope that you actually go back and listen to some of the older episodes, and hope you stick around for a lot more because, you know, if I do say so myself, I like to think we're getting better each week we do this. If not, well, I guess I'm not doing too well. Oh, so let's do some email. Desi, are you with me on some email here?
All right.
Let me do this little theme music here first. Okay, and our first email this week, and we have a few. I'm going to try to burn through these because I know we got a lot of great stuff to talk about coming up. Our first email is from Blue60, who says, "Mr. Stank, who does the intro and where can I find it?" Just kidding. Greetings from Canada. I've been listening since episode 25. I heard on Ep 73, I believe you were talking about Hotmail and the storage limits. I have had my Hotmail account since before Microsoft got their dirty hooks in it. A lot of people don't even remember that Hotmail has not always been a Microsoft product, by the way. Before they got their dirty hooks in it, and my account was boosted to 250 megabytes of space about a month before the notice was sent out about the upgrades. But my girlfriend's account is still only at 2 megs. Just thought you would find that interesting. Also, just so you know, the show is being heard all the way in the Northwest Territories. I know you love hearing about listeners in odd places. Keep up the kick-ass show. I will be a listener as long as you keep up the great rants. P.S. I'd like to say thank you to Duel for the timeless classics known as Radio Freak America. On behalf of Duel, I know he would say thank you. And great segue that I just mentioned it earlier. People are still downloading. It's still a great show. I listen to it myself once in a while. So the introduction is done by Zerl. Now, I know he was joking about it because we get a lot of emails of people asking. But his site, Zerls.com, Zerle.com, is actually down right now. So I kind of used this email to mention to everyone that, yes, I know that his site is down. I've emailed him about it. I don't know what's going on, but I'm sure they're going to be working to get it up soon. Hopefully, even by the time you're listening to this, maybe it will be back up. Now, the Hotmail thing, yeah, I mentioned this before about how I seem to not get my 250 meg bump until much, much later than everyone else. Do you have, Decius, a Hotmail account by chance?
Well, sort of. I have one, but I don't really use it. I have no idea how much storage space I have.
Yeah, see, that's kind of the way I'm getting now. I'm trying to pull away from it and just not use it at all anyway. So, yeah, I do still use it. Unfortunately, I still have it registered at some places, and it takes time to convert over.
Yep.
But, yeah, I had, you know, it was 2 megs of space, and between the spam and everything else, it was just becoming useless. And they claimed they were going to bump it to 250, but they didn't do it. You know, they took their sweet time about it. They announced it on one day and said that they were going to be doing it, you know, effective immediately, but I didn't see it until months later. And obviously this person here, Blue60, is saying that his went up to 250 right away, but his girlfriend's went down, is still at 2 megs and hasn't gone up. So they're rolling this out, I guess, in phases a little bit at a time. So you'd think that by now they would have it done. I know Yahoo, well, I don't know, but I've never heard anybody say that Yahoo didn't bump them up. They bumped everybody up to 250, like, all at the same time, from what I understand. And, of course, they're all playing catch-up to Google, to Gmail.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, interesting. I didn't realize that there were still people that didn't have 250. So, yeah, that is interesting to hear that. I wonder how much longer they're going to take. I wonder if it's a matter of them... Maybe the big Microsoft can't afford the hard drives. Maybe they can't afford the storage space.
It's pretty amazing that Google is offering a gig.
Yeah.
They've really, you know, they've really, like, raised the bar. But, I mean, that's a fair amount of storage space.
Yeah, and it's actually... There was a program, and we talked about it on the show in the past. As a matter of fact, I think I mentioned a week or two ago about how there was something called Gmail FS,
mm-hmm.
which was somebody had written an application that would map a drive to your Gmail account and use it for storage space. And that was really, really cool.
Yep, I think that's a neat idea.
Yeah, and we all knew it wouldn't last long, and it was shut down a couple weeks ago. It was notified.
Was it?
Yeah, so I mentioned that on the show. We knew that was coming. I mean, I don't think anybody was surprised at that so much. But...
I don't know. They let you store a gig. You know, who cares what kind of content it is or how you're accessing it?
Yeah, but they...
I really don't see, you know, well, I guess the gimmick is that they don't really want people to use it. They aren't really giving you a gig, and if you... You know, if you really have a gig up there, they'll find some way for you to suddenly not have so much storage space, which is kind of crummy.
Yeah, but they want that. They want to be able to put those ads on your email. They want to be able to put those ads on the side. That's why I also predict that they're going to shut down the free POP3 access. They claim they're not, and it says in their fact they have no intention whatsoever of ending the POP3. But I suspect that I think my prediction was that they're either going to end it and start charging for it, or they're going to manipulate your messages to send those ads. They're going to embed them into the individual emails. They'll claim that they're not reading them. They'll use their computer system to insert them harmlessly, they'll think, into the emails and then send them on to your POP3. But I don't think that they're going to provide free POP3 access for everybody. I don't see
how... That's a reasonable way for them to deal with that. Now, I just decided to Google this. It says that, or the GmailFS website says, I've received reports that the formatting of the page has changed. You know, do we know for sure that they intended to shut down GmailFS, or do we think that maybe they just made some sort of change to the way their page looks that broke the software, but wasn't really intended to break the software?
I had heard reports in a couple places that they had known about it and intentionally change the way they do things to break it. Whether that was just a page design layout or style, I really would not know. I might have to look into that for the next episode, or if one of our listeners can confirm that, by all means, radio@benrev.com. Email us and let us know. Oh, and yeah, greets to the Northwest Territory. I think that's really cool. I always love, as corny as it may sound, I love the fact that there are people in other countries listening to our show. I think that's fantastic. I think it's great. So, shout-outs to you guys up in the Great White North.
It's pretty amazing that you can get good internet access up there.
Yeah. You think the penguins would, you know, mess up all the... No penguins. All right, shut up. Shoot me. Whatever. Second email from... Hey, it was funny. Second email this week is from Sequel, and I am pronouncing that correctly this time. Sequel, who says, hello again, listening to episode 78 finally, and here you mention me. Thanks for the information on the book, and yes, I will accept the book. Thank you very much for that. Name and address will be listed below, which of course I'm not going to read on the air. Wasn't really expecting it to be read in the episode. Just to answer your questions about my last email, my boss is what you would consider a hacker as well. He is older, but one of the closest things to an original hacker as you will find. He took an open source app used for tracking troubleshooting tickets and completely rewrote it for the company we work for. He realizes that a lot of the techs working for him are really into tech and computer geeks, and a few who consider themselves hackers based on the original meaning of the word. Given this knowledge, when he came across Hack TV, he thought that most of us would like it, and most of us have. I've been trying to let people know about the radio show because not many people know about it. Sequel, pronounced Sequel, as I'm pronouncing it, it, just FYI, is a transliterated Hebrew word that means wisdom. When deciding on a moniker, I figured I would use something to represent my goal in life. One final thing, when you do release the next version of Hack TV, I would like to offer to host a mirror if possible. Oh, man, there's a lot of good stuff here. Siegel, again, thank you for the email. And anything that comes into RadioBenRev.com is likely to be read on the air. Unless you specifically tell me otherwise, send it to StankDog.com. Some of those I might read on the air, but anything to radio is probably going to get read on the air if it's, you know, something I want to bring up on the air. And in your case, I mean, this is a second. I mean, both emails that you sent have been really good stuff, really good points that I wanted to bring up. And Desi, as you might not know the reference here, but there was a book that written by Eric Giles. It's called Terror Cell. And it is a kind of a, how do I describe it? It is a book where the main character is a hacker. And the hacker's the good guy for a change. So it's kind of a suspense thriller story. But instead of being the hacker, terrorist, bad guy, the hacker is actually the good guy in the story. So he has written for Blacklisted 411. I've spoken to him in email quite a few times. Really good guy. And last week we told everybody that it still has not published. But I do have a couple pre-release copies. Well, actually, I don't now. Your pre-release copy, Sequel, I'm going to send it to you as soon as I can get to the post office. So I will send that out ASAP. And it's great to hear old school guys teaching traditional hacking to people. And you can tell from the way this email was worded, at least I could, reading between the lines a little bit, that somebody gets it. So I like that. And also, if I can say so, I think that's a great handle. Sequel, I think that's very interesting. It has a meaning. It has a significance. And even the way you worded it, that it's a goal in life, is wisdom. I mean, everybody should have that goal in life. I wish more people had that goal in life. So I very much like the handle. Original, it has significance and meaning. That's a very cool handle. Oh, and a mirror. Thank you for offering a mirror, and we are going to be needing it soon. Very soon to needing it. We just released a special episode of Hack TV called Pwned. And I don't know, I probably won't put you on the spot, Desi, because you might not have had time to watch it yet. We released a special show called Pwned of Hack TV that we filmed at Freaknik, where we were next door neighbors, by the way. And we could use mirrors for that. Right now, that one's fine. It's a smaller show. But when episode 2 comes out sometime very soon, I'll probably put out a call for mirrors in the forums or on my personal website. So when that time comes, and if you can still provide a mirror, that would be fantastic. Or anybody that can provide a mirror, because when we release the full real episodes, the site just gets hammered. And BitTorrent helps a little bit, but we're still the main seed, and it still eats away at our bandwidth. So we definitely would appreciate anybody that can do that. And for those of you who don't know about Pwned, I actually released Pwned on the 15th of January, a few days back, and I announced it on StankDog.com first, and then I updated BenRev.com and HackTV.BenRev.com shortly after that. I don't want to rely on the forums all the time. We're creating a lot of projects, and I want people to go to BenRev.com, the main site, and check out for news and new projects and things like that. I don't want people coming straight to the forums. I know that's like a very popular part of the site and everything, but you bypass and you miss a lot of stuff. So check the main page, and you'll see all of our announcements and all of our projects and stuff, because we're rolling so many out right now. So many projects that it's just like, it's too much for me to write out and type up that we're in. It's so much work just to announce the projects, it seems like, these days. So, let's see. And I assume you probably haven't seen Pwned yet, right?
No, I saw your discussion of it, but I haven't checked it out yet.
Yeah, that was filmed. You might like it, especially because, like I said, we were neighbors there at Freaknik. And you'll recognize a lot of the scenes and a lot of the people in background, et cetera, et cetera. So you'll like it. You'll get a kick out of it, I think.
All right.
So let's see. Email number 3 comes from Nugget. It says, I've been listening to all the back episodes for the past couple of weeks. Love the show. It is very awesome, and I listen to about 18 episodes on my MP3 player during school Monday through Friday. On the weekends, I listen to about 18.2 while I'm surfing the net and reading up on Perl programming. Keep up the good work almost through the first season. Well, that's a lot of listening. That's a lot of stuff to take in.
This guy's failing out of school because he's listening to your radio show, Stan.
I was getting ready to make that joke, and I'm like, wait a minute, listening to it during school? Oh, man, am I contributing to... Well, not to sound like a jerk, but he might be learning more from the show than he is in school, but that's a whole nother conversation. We won't go there. I'm sure he means during study hall and gym or something like that. I'm sure he's not sacrificing his education. Especially the kids, he's learning, I shouldn't say kid, the young man is learning Perl programming at the same time, too. So, sounds like he can handle multiple things at once. But joking aside, you're listening, you say you're almost done with first season, so I assume you probably started from the beginning or something, which is great. I kind of said this at the opening of the show. I really believe that the show is getting better and better each week. I really believe that. And maybe it's me being biased, maybe it's just, I just like to think that we're getting better, and if we're not getting better each week, then I'm not doing what I set out to do. I mean, I want to keep learning and keep giving new information, and I guess the more we do it, the more comfortable we get, and the more, you know, the easier it is. I mean, it's getting to the point these days where we have to stop ourselves after an hour and a half. I mean, I mean honestly, Decius, you and I could make this a four-hour episode easily if we didn't have to go to work in the morning.
Man.
I mean,
yeah,
honestly.
Yeah, we probably could.
I mean, we can honestly sit here and just talk and talk and talk. There's just so much information, and, you know, anyway, if you like the first season, I hope you'll like the second season even more. So, at the rate you're going, dude, by the time you hear this, you will have listened to all of them, who knows how many times. It'll be interesting. Let's see if he's really going in order. He might not even hear his letter, his name, read on the air until a month or two from now. That could be fun. All right. So, yes, thank you for listening. Let's see. Another email from Deshi. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Dude, first off, once again, Stank, you have come through with a piece of software that is just genius. I tried out Mambo after hearing you talk highly of it on BenRev. I didn't come out with it. I just said I liked it. Okay. But I know what you mean. Well, it's been a couple of days, and I'm addicted to it. Mambo makes keeping your site updated a simple and easy task. I, too, am recommending anyone looking for a good content management system to give Mambo a try. Now, wickedradio.org, that's one word, wickedradio.org, is running smoother than ever and is more interactive for my listeners. Thanks. Well, again, you're welcome. I like Mambo. I'm happy with it. I'm using that on stankdog.com, just my personal site. But I'm not really pushing it too hard. I just want a content management system for exactly what you described, putting up content quickly, organized, etc. I'd like to hear if anybody's out there that's running a big site, a large or business production environment on it. I'd like to hear how stable it is in a scenario like that. Most places I see it are running a small site on it, even a medium-sized site that gets quite a few hits, but you're not really taking advantage of a lot of the flexibility and stuff that I think might be there. So if anybody is pushing it and has done some really extra creative stuff, like I think I saw Porsche Brazil, I think, is running their site on it or switching over to it, and that's something interesting. I'd like to see how it handles that kind of load. And for those who missed it, go back to episode 76. This is 79. Go back three episodes, and that was my review of Mambo. It was main topic of that show, so if you're interested, go back and check out episode 76. But, yeah, definitely, it's one of the best ones I've seen. I also still like E107. There's quite a few good content management systems out there, and then there's some that are over-engineered, frankly. I'm not a fan of the PHP nuke and the post nuke. I'm not a fan of them. Have you used any content management systems for any? I mean, obviously, MemeStreams is a whole in-house custom.
Yeah, I basically wrote my own. So no,
yeah.
I guess I messed with PH Project at one point because I had a client who, you know, could use it, but I really haven't delved into that space that much.
Right, and yeah, like you said, with meme streams, and I guess we might as well pimp memestreams.net, custom...
That's M-E-M-E streams. No one can spell meme.
Yeah, M-E-M-E-S-T-R-E-A-M-S.net is all custom in-house stuff, and... Did you mention to me that you're making some changes to that soon, too? Maybe we should wait and talk about that in the show and tell coming up.
All right.
Okay, so, yeah, episode 76 for Mambo. Go check that out if you're interested. And our last email this week is from, let's see, Ruam Fandango. Oh, I guess I'm saying that right. Ruam Fandango, who says, "Hi there, Stank. I am a huge fan of Ben Rev Radio. When I wrote this mail, I realized that I've been listening to the show for almost exactly 1 year now." Almost exactly. Never mind. Time flies. "Being a crypto fan, I really enjoyed the episode with Ilanka. You seemed very interested in the topic, so I wanted to let you know about a great book on cryptography. It's called, quote, 'Code Book: The Secret History of Codes and Code Breaking,' end quote, by Simon Singh." I don't know if I should read this. Yeah, I'll read the ISBN number in case anybody wants to search on Amazon or something like that. It's ISBN 1-85702-889-9. If you don't know anything about cryptography but want to learn more about it, this book is perfect to get you started. It is not overly technical, but it will give you a good overview of past, present, and even future ciphers, how they work, but also their historical background. I remember you saying in one of the recent episodes you're not interested in history, so you make it a little bored during parts of the book. Singh manages to explain all this in a manner everyone can follow. But there's more. At the end, there's a section called the Cipher Challenge. It consists of 10 ciphertexts waiting to be broken by you, where you can apply what you've learned throughout the book. Starts with simple ciphers you can crack with pen and paper, and gets more and more complicated towards the end. Talking about new search engines, we're switching gears here. Talking about new search engines, a few days ago I stumbled upon one which is specialized in finding source code. It's located at www.coders.com. That's coders with a K, K-O-D-E-R-S, coders.com. Besides the usual keywords, it lets you search for a specific language and copyright license. I haven't really looked into it, but it certainly does look interesting. I'm currently exploring the uncharted, i.e. little documented, territories of free BSD raw IP programming. If they get anything useful out of it, that might be something for docdroppers.org. Okay, that's enough for now. Keep up the great work." Wow. Boy, there's a lot in this to take apart, and this, we saved this for the last email to kind of segue into our main topic later on, that where I'm going to shut up finally for a while, and Desi isn't going to do a lot more of the talking here, is, and that's cryptography again. We're going to go into a little bit further detail of it. But, yeah, time definitely flies. I mean, almost exactly 1 year, which I think that's a conflict of words there. But coders.com, I did go check it out, that you mentioned in your email, coders.com, and I liked it. I thought it was pretty good. It's kind of strange and awkward that it's kind of a natural word search engine, if you will, to search for source code, which isn't exactly an easy thing to do. It's actually searching the syntax, actually searching the source code itself. So if you had like a particular function that you wanted to see how someone else was using it, how the function call works, or something like that, then you can put it in and search and by language, etc., which is kind of handy. But if you're searching by keyword, like I tried to look up a couple things that I'm working on, and unless there's comments in stream, which is something I've said on the show many times, comment your code, people. Put comments in there. Unless they have comments in there kind of explaining the code topic and things like that, then you might not find what you're looking for. However, anybody who can do advanced Google searching and, you know, how to do some advanced searching on any of the search engines, control strings, literals, etc., stuff like that, you should be able to find what you're looking for fairly easily on that.
I think that's a really neat resource. I mean, a lot of times you're working on a project and you need a library or something and you don't want to implement it yourself, and that might be a fast way to find something useful. And I think also I sometimes get frustrated with Google because Google doesn't handle certain kinds of technical searches well. For instance, I think if you have a period inside of, you know, have like word.word, for example,
right,
it'll remove the dot and treat it as a space.
Exactly.
And that can be frustrating when you're looking for something that's, say, you know, like a method within an object, and you get all these results that, you know, that don't really relate to what you're looking for. And, you know, I wish Google tweaked some of their stuff, but, you know, they have their own set of criteria. They're trying to be a general purpose tool. And I think that, you know, this isn't necessarily the tool that I'm talking about either, but it would be neat to see sort of a search engine that was designed for technical people who are looking for technical information and are searching for things like, you know, things like code. You know, I think that's a really neat idea, and I think that there's a lot of people who need that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this will be successful, and I hope it's successful. And if there's anything I can do, I'll mention it on the site and provide links to it. I think it is definitely a good project and a good productive thing. So it's definitely something I think people will use. And like you said, not only that, but I would also look for it if I'm having problems using a particular class or something like that. Let me go look and see what somebody else did. Maybe I'm calling it wrong. Maybe I'm passing the parameters wrong, you know, something like that. Maybe I can take a look at what somebody else has done it to figure out what I may have done wrong. So not only, you know, saving reusable code by not reinventing the wheel, you can go find someone's code, possibly use parts of it, but also just for simple debugging. You know, if you're like me, it seems like I've had bad luck where I get the assignments at work that no one else can do. So when I get stuck, or when I get to a point where I can't figure something out, I can't really call someone over. I can't say, hey, Decius, come take a look over my shoulder. Did I miss something silly like am I missing a parentheses somewhere? Is there a semicolon misplaced or something? I don't really have that all the time. So this would be a good resource for me simply for debugging. So that's kind of a cool thing to have.
I wish every man page in Unix was connected to a discussion board so that, you know, if you pulled up the man page and it wasn't really telling you what you wanted, you'd press a button and links would fire up and pull up a discussion board where people might have talked about that particular command.
That's actually an interesting idea, and I think that's very feasible to do technically.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It's something that I kicked around in my head many moons ago and never bothered to do anything with, but this discussion reminds me of it. You know, sometimes you just need to talk to some people about what you're doing, and, you know, communities can develop information that sits around the sort of standard documentation that can be really helpful. So it would be neat to do that, but I've never bothered to try.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that would also be a great tool of differentiation, kind of from a business word there, for a distribution to incorporate. You know, I would want all of the man pages to have that. I think it would be open source. It would have to be. But I think the first distribution that would, you know, if that was something that I don't know, Mandrake were to implement first, I think that would really separate them apart and generate a lot of interest to their distribution, that all of their man pages come tied back to forums at Mandrake that have exactly what you're talking about.
To be honest with you, and to do this, I think the term is lazy web, where you come up with an idea you'd like to see and you know, just sort of post about it and hope that someone says, hey, that's a good idea, and does it. You know, if you were to create an alternate form of the man command called, like, P-man or something like that, or D-man, and, I'm sure that, you know, Debian or one of these other distributions would be happy to, you know, pick it up. And, you know, that's one way to get it started, get it on people's Debian boxes, get it on people's Gentoo boxes, get them discussing stuff, and then, you know, after it gains some momentum, I think you'd see, begin to see, like, bigger distributions deciding to switch over to it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So there you go. Somebody take it and run with it. And see, the other thing is maybe the people that are putting together the distributions, maybe they have the manpower. Maybe they would be willing to do that as a strategy to kind of set themselves apart, you know?
Like, yeah, that's interesting.
RPM, Red Hat Package Manager, you know, that kind of became... Well, anyway, let's move on. I'll stop right there.
I want to say another thing about this email. Do you mind if I continue to preempt you?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I noticed this book recommendation for a book about the history of cryptography, and there's a lot of interesting books about the history of cryptography, and I have kind of a off the wall or kind of a different perspective. Most of them talk about the military history of cryptography, and I have my own book recommendation, which talks about the what I would call the computer underground's role in the history of cryptography, and it's called Crypto. And it's written by this guy named Stephen Levy, who is he's a very well-known author. He's written a lot of interesting books about hackers, about artificial life, about lots of very interesting computer topics in the last 20 years. He's a pretty important internet age journalist, and he wrote this book. The subtitle of this book is "How the Crypto Rebels Beat the Government: Saving Privacy in the Digital Age." And it's about the cypherpunks, who are a group of hackers in the sort of San Francisco, Silicon Valley area. They're mostly centered around there. There's a few in England and the like, and they have a mailing list, and for the last decade or more, actually, they've been talking about crypto, and their goal is to write useful crypto applications that protect people's privacy and to get them into the hands of people. And cypherpunks write code. They write crypto code, and they're a very interesting group, and they had a lot of influence on the debate that occurred, as personal computers, and I may get into this a little bit more later, but there's weak cryptography that you can do in a piece of paper, and then there's strong cryptography that you can do in a computer. Excuse me. And when people started getting personal computers, they started being able to do strong cryptography at home, and that created a new environment for sort of national intelligence agencies, because traditionally the way that they collected intelligence was by listening to phone calls, listening to listening to other kinds of telecommunications, and prospect of everybody having a cryptography device in their living room was sort of a radical change for them. And so their initial gut reaction was to crush it, and there was a policy debate in the United States throughout the 90s about things like the Clipper chip and the like, where about controls on export of cryptography that attempted to at least constrain the development of this for some period of time, so that the intelligence agencies could sort of figure out how they were going to work in this new world. And certainly the cypherpunks had a great deal of influence in sort of getting this stuff into people's hands and really sort of influence the debate about what our policies should be about people having cryptography, and whether or not people should be allowed to have cryptography, and whether or not you should have the right to run those kinds of programs on your computer. They've been tremendously influential, and this is a really neat book because it's a really neat kind of group, and it's a recent history. And I think that this book will be very important 100 years from now when people look back at they want to ask what is the history of cryptography. They're going to ask about the military history, and they're also going to ask about this. It's going to be just as important. So that's Crypto by Stephen Levy, Levy. So anyway, that's my spiel about that.
Cool, very cool. And you can go check out Amazon or any of the other online sites and do a search for that. And let's see, and without that, that could go into a whole other topic and tangent too. But just to put my opinion out there on the record, we have a right to privacy in this country, and tools that assist in that right, I don't think should even be considered to be banned or illegal or even questionable. And I think that's just a silly notion. Just to put that out there. Let's see, and yeah, we're gonna go into some more crypto stuff. So, in a few minutes, but before we do, oh, sorry, he mentioned also about Doc Droppers, which since he brought it up, if, by all means, let me pimp DocDroppers.org. Of course, people who listen to the show regularly already know that we've been talking about that lately. But this is a library of hacking information, articles, how tos. We don't put up anything that's copywritten manuals, but if you want to write man pages type things and step by step stuff like that, that's what it's about. So almost nothing will be turned down other than copywritten material. We want to put together a whole library of all of this kind of stuff, and the only limit that we have on it is the limit of whatever disk space we have. As long as we've got the space for it, we want anything and everything that anybody wants to submit, so please feel free. We've been getting a lot of visitors to the site. A few people have added stuff already. A few people have made suggestions and comments and things, which is fantastic, exactly what we want. So please keep adding stuff, and if disk space does become an issue, we've accepted from before we started this project that we are committed to increasing the space. If it gets to the point where it's big enough that we've got to expand hard drives and pay extra for it, we think that this is valuable enough that we will do it. So by all means, anybody that wants to submit anything to Doc Droppers, by all means, check it out. And yeah, I was sincere about my interest in crypto as well. I mean, I was very sincere. I've always found it intriguing, but I've never had someone to put it to me where I feel comfortable with it. Like, the word, and this is going to may sound kind of corny to you or may kind of silly, but the simple fact of the matter is the word cryptography is in a strange way intimidating. It just sounds so overwhelming, and I can't tell you why. It just does. It just feels like, whoa, cryptography. I can't learn cryptography. That's too complex. Cryptography's too hard. That's too, you know. I don't know why it has that connotation, but it does for some reason. So I am very interested in it, and now that I'm getting, you know, a crash course, if you will, along with the listeners. I mean, I'm learning along with the listeners as far as this line of stuff goes. So I am genuinely interested. About not being interested in history, I'm not really interested in history in general. Like, I can't sit and watch the History Channel. And you're the exact opposite, aren't you?
You mean the War Channel? I love the War Channel.
The War Channel, exactly. Like, Zero DB. Zero DB can sit and watch the History Channel all day long. I can't stand it. It's over and done with. That kind of history does bore me. But not technology. I am very much interested in technology and history. But in a corny way, it's because I lived through some of the history of technology. You know?
Yep, I know.
It makes you feel old, doesn't it?
Okay, so let's not get into that topic.
Yeah, and actually, I am so motivated, so interested in this that now that I've know a little bit more about it, I'm actually thinking of putting together some challenges for the listeners. May not be like real complex ones, and I'm not trying to make something that no one's going to figure out for years and years. But I may put together a few simple things just for people to play along with, just for anybody who wants to try it along with me. And maybe we'll use some from this book. Well, see, I can't really, because then you get copyright issues, yada yada. I'll try to make something up if I get time, and maybe I'll call on you to help me if you have time. I know we're both busy people, but maybe I can put something together and have some occasional crypto challenges on the show just for the fun of it.
Cool.
So, let's segue. Let's do a quick show and tell, and kind of segue. We've already started talking about a lot of crypto stuff, but for my show and tell, I've been doing some research on podcasting in general and researching some specific podcasting sites. And researching is the polite word that I'm going to use, and I'm going to leave it at that. The guys over at Infonomicon may tell you different, but don't trust a word they say. And I've been doing some filming and editing for Hack TV Episode 2. I actually did that today before I called you. So did some Hack TV stuff today. Actually, I probably shouldn't say this, but not only Episode 2, but Episode 3. So we've got quite a bit of footage. We're in the editing process. Hopefully you'll be hearing something very soon. It's the blurring process. Blurring out certain things, that takes for freaking ever. Oh, And had some meetings talking about some upcoming hacking conferences, and we might have some more announcements or things to mention about that in the future. But that's pretty much been it for me this past week. And how about you? I know you've been hard at work on what was that new project? GTA?
Yeah.
What was
exactly.
That?
I've been absolutely useless since I got a copy of Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. And I'm not a gamer, really. It's actually been several years since I've gotten sucked into a game and not done anything but played this game for a while. Uh-huh. But, yeah, it's pretty bad. You know, I'll get home from work and fire it up and, you know, drive around, start shooting stuff. And, you know, next thing I know, it's like 1 a.m. and I haven't done even my email yet. And I'm like, man, I got to go to bed. Uh-huh. So, I don't know. It's a long game, man. I might be useless for a while. I don't know. Earlier you'd asked about meme streams. I guess the thing that's going on there is that we've got a server now for development, and we've had a number of people who have been able to get involved because of that. We had some roadblocks to that previously because of the complexity of actually setting it up on a machine, but we now have an environment where people who want to contribute to the development can come and work on the project without having to figure out how to get it working. And some people have made some selfless contributions to the project, and for that we're very grateful, because we now have a feeling like we'll actually be able to get the new revision of the code out to the site sometime. And it's not a hopeless dream. And I probably should be contributing more to that, but instead, at least this week, I've been driving around shooting people. But I'm pretty excited about that.
Now I'm gonna take that clip out of context of you saying I'm just driving around shooting.
Great.
I want to be like
good.
I want to be like the.
When I run for office, I'm hoping that everything that I discussed here on Bin Rev Radio like comes back to haunt me.
I was gonna say I want to be like the real mass media. Take clips out of context and splice them all together.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have.
Go take this to the next level, thanks.
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to take it up. I'm gonna be right up there. I'm gonna be the next. What's the guy that just quit? Dan Rather? Is that
Dan Rather?
Yeah,
right.
I'm gonna take his job. Yeah, right. Believe that. Nope. I think I am sticking right here with internet radio, sticking at my with my family, as it were. We have a good solid half an hour. We have a good solid half an hour, I think, here to talk about our main topic today, and one of your areas of expertise, I guess I should say. We talked last week. Of course, we had Alanka on, who is again a mutual friend of ours. And she gave us a great, great show talking about cryptography in general, how it works, pattern recognition, a lot of theory-level things of how and why it works, and, you know, the interest factor of how to tell and some things you can do by pen and paper, etc. And we also then went on to talk about how that's just the basics and the fundamentals. However, it gets very, very complex, being that it can be a heavily mathematic-based system, and so much so that you can't do it in your head, you can't do it in pen and paper or calculator, and that's where computers come in. Now, unfortunately, we don't have time to do all of that in one episode, so Desis is on the show this week, and I thought, if you'll indulge me, that we would go through maybe some of the application level stuff and of cryptography, and like where it's used, why it's used, some of the, well, just generally, just the application of cryptography as we know it, because as hackers and as computer geeks, etc., when we hear cryptography, at least I guess I should speak for myself, when I hear cryptography, it's always in relation to computers. You know, it's always about this new algorithm or this new key structure or this new breakthrough, et cetera, et cetera. It's always computer-based stuff. Now that we know why it's so tied to computers, let's see how it's used for us and on computers. For example, Well, first of all, I guess we should probably start with something as simple as terminology again. We talked about some basic terms last week, like what is cryptography, what is ciphertext and plain text, et cetera, et cetera. There's a couple important terms before we really go on. Is that correct? Is there?
Sure.
Specifically, I guess, because I'm speaking slowly because I want to make sure I say these right because I get them confused. I guess the two of the most fundamental things is the type of keys being used, the type of technology behind them. One being, well, I guess they're asymmetric or versus symmetric key systems. So what is one versus the, I mean, what are the applications of the two of these? What are the differences?
Okay. Well, I mean, let me step back one step, and then I'll step back into this question.
Okay.
I mean, cryptography is something that people have done since the beginning of time. And up until the invention of computers, everything had to be done with pencil and paper because that's all you had. And, you know, there was a short period of time when you had these mechanical encryption machines, like during the Second World War, you know, that were slightly more advanced than pen and paper. But, you know, the computers really revolutionized the space. And so today, what people do for cryptography is way more advanced than, you know, it's light years beyond what people were doing even 50 years ago. You know, and that's where you get into computer technology, and that's where this stuff gets really intimidating because it's no longer in the real world a matter of sort of, you know, kind of creative code cracking with a piece of paper and a pen. You know, it's really a matter of very elite mathematics, applied mathematics. So you know, it's I guess one of the critical issues, and one of the, I guess the starting point for many people in terms of talking about cryptography, is to ask the question that you just asked. And, you know, in a sort of idealistic crypto system that you might sort of naively imagine, if you don't have any experience with cryptography, you would imagine this program on your computer that encrypts files, and it takes a password, and you run this program and give it the password, and it encrypts the file, and you memorize the password, and then later on you can come to it and enter your password and decrypt the file. And that is what we call symmetric cryptography. And the reason it's called symmetric is because you're using the same key to encrypt and decrypt the file. So if you and I wanted to exchange messages using a symmetric crypto system, we would have to figure out how to share the secret key. So if you and I like met up at a con somewhere, I could give you a secret key, and then when we went back to our where we live, you know, we could send messages that were encrypted with that secret key to each other, and we both have the key and could decrypt it.
So basically, we're just sharing the password between us, or sharing sharing the key, as it were, which in this case is a password.
Right.
Okay.
And, you know, what's happening in this program is that some very advanced, you know, algorithms are being used to take the information in this file and obfuscate it, both by spreading it around and by changing one thing into another thing, and so that the resulting file is unintelligible without the key. So the problem that's presented by the internet is that, you know, a lot of people you want to talk to on the internet you've never met in real life, and you're not going to meet in real life. And you might want to send them a private message. You might want to, this is Whitfield Diffie's explanation, and I think it's really good. You might want to whisper to someone on the internet, and you want to be able to whisper to somebody on the internet. And the problem there is that, you know, with symmetric cryptography, in order to be able to do that, you've got to exchange a key. And in order to exchange a key, you have to have a place where you can do that you think is secure. If you think someone is monitoring all of your internet communications, then, you know, you can't send the key out over that channel because then they'll have it. So, and Whitfield Diffie invented this a along with Martin Hellman, and it was also simultaneously invented by this guy named Ralph Merkel. But he invented the concept of public key cryptography, or what should be called asymmetric cryptography. And asymmetric cryptosystems have two keys instead of one. And when you encrypt a message with one key, you have to use the other key to decrypt it. And it works both ways. In most cases, different systems work differently. But in most cases, if you encrypt the message with key one, you have to decrypt it with key two. And if you encrypt the message with key two, you have to encrypt it with key one. Does this make sense so far?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you misspoke or if I misheard you there, but if you encrypt it with key one, you have to decrypt it with key two.
Right.
But if you encrypt it with key two, you can decrypt it with key one?
Exactly.
Okay.
The it works both ways.
Gotcha.
You have two keys, and if you encrypt with one of the keys, either one, then you have to use the other key to decrypt.
Gotcha. Now, without going into the detail of the individual algorithms, are there overlap? Can the same algorithms be used with symmetric that are used with asymmetric? Is the algorithm itself irrelevant to the application type?
No, it's not.
It's not.
Certain algorithms provide an asymmetric system, and certain algorithms provide a symmetric system. I don't know of an algorithm that can do both. I'm not going to declare that it's impossible for one that one might be invented, but I'm not familiar with any. I don't think that we know of any.
I see.
Or that anyone has invented one.
I see.
And what you see, I'll get into this. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but sometimes you see hybrid systems where you use a asymmetric cryptosystem to do key exchange, and then underneath it you have a symmetric cryptosystem because symmetric cryptosystems are usually faster. But we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So the thing you can do with asymmetric crypto is you can do a public and private key setup where, like, there's two keys. If you encrypt with one, you have to decrypt with the other. So you take one of them and you declare it your private key, and you keep it a secret. You don't give it to anybody else.
So
then you take the other key and you give it to everyone on the Internet.
So can you think of your private key then back to early? I know we're talking about asymmetric now, but can you think of it like the symmetric example earlier, where the private key out of that pair is like your private password that only you know that you keep?
Right.
And your public key.
The public key, you can you know. Write it on the side of a big building. You can, you know, shout it from the mountaintop. You can post it to IRC. You know, everyone should get it.
Gotcha.
And that's how it works. So the way this works, if you think about it, messages that you encrypt with one key should be decrypted with the other one. So when someone wants to send you a message on the Internet,
you've told
everybody your public key, so everybody's got it.
Let's use you for an example. Let's use you for an example, because I know specifically that on meme streams, you have your public key up there. Am I correct with that?
That's true. If you go to my profile on meme streams, it's right there.
So that's how you're saying publicly you put it on the building, you put it out there to everywhere. So if I wanted to send you a message and have faith or trust that it was going to be encrypted, that only you would receive it, by using your public key, and the example you said earlier, by using your key, the only way to decode it is by using your private key. So if I encrypt using your public key, I know that you're the only person, theoretically, that can open that.
That's true. If you encrypt with my public key, then the only person that can read the message is me, because the only key that can decrypt the message is the private key, and I'm the only person that has it.
Again, now, back in your previous example, I mentioned that in your symmetric, you were talking about just basically it's really more like a simple password example that you gave us. You can verbally tell someone your password and share the file. Is that not the case with this asymmetric? I mean, your private key, could you not send that to someone, or could someone not steal the file or steal your private key somehow and therefore be able to decode your that email that was intended only for you?
They could. That's why it's very important that you keep your private key private.
There we go.
Now, I don't want to get off on a tangent because I'm going to make things too complex, but there is okay. a case where you might want to do that, and it's a very special case called a subliminal channel, but maybe we'll talk about that another time.
Okay.
In general, your private key is private, and you don't want to let anyone touch it. Usually, what programs will do is encrypt your private key with a symmetric cipher, and you'll have to remember a password for the symmetric cipher in order to unlock your private key so that you can read your messages. And a lot of times what people like to do is keep their private key maybe on one of those USB tokens that
exactly.
you keep in your pocket, so, you know, it's always on your person and no one can get it, copy off your hard drive when you're not around.
That's exactly what I was going to suggest.
Some smart cards that you get are specifically designed to have private keys in them and to do private key operations without exposing the key. They're supposed to be tamper-proof. They're not totally tamper-proof, but they're very, very expensive to tamper with in order to get the private key out of them.
Yeah, and another example I think would be a good application of protection is a level of physical security, which is always good to have a combination. I've seen that they're not as cheap as a regular USB drive, but I know they make USB thumb drives that actually use fingerprint technology. Now, yeah, we can go into a whole tangent on how that could be faked as well, but in generally speaking, if you were to put your private key on a USB card and then have that layer of security where only your thumbprint could then access that USB key, that adds two layers to your protection because, as silly as it sounds, somebody could jack you up and take your USB key with now your private key on it.
They can also lob your finger off.
Right, some three-letter, right. Well, true, but some three-letter agencies may confiscate your USB drive, and now they've got your private key, and they can be encrypting your email.
Yeah.
Which I do, it's very rare and highly unlikely, but it is a scary possibility.
Yeah. So, I mean, the reality is that you have to be serious about keeping your private key private. But I want to talk about another interesting element to this, which, remember when I said you encrypt the message with one key and then you decrypt it with the other one. So in our first use case, someone is sending me a message, so they are encrypting the message with my public key, and then I'm decrypting it with my private key. What if we did things the other way around? What if I were to encrypt the message with my private key and send it out, and everybody could decrypt it with my public key, which everyone has? What would be the purpose of that? If anybody can read the message, what's the point of encrypting it? Well, the value is that they know that I sent it, because only I have my private key. I've done a good job of keeping people from stealing it from me. And so only I could have encrypted this message in such a way that it could be decrypted with my public key. So it's a digital signature.
That is an excellent example, and I know exactly where you're going. That's an excellent example.
So, that's really the two interesting things that, at a fundamental level, this asymmetric cryptosystems offer. The first is the ability to do encryption for the sake of privacy without having to meet up to exchange a password. And the second is the ability to authenticate or to sign documents so that you know where they're coming from. And those are both used in all kinds of systems in production in the internet. You know, everyone uses them every day because they enable TCP sockets between computers to be encrypted and to exchange keys for encryption, and they also enable internet access to be authenticated so that we know who is attempting to use a computer and whether or not they're authorized to do so.
I see. Now, that last example that you gave, then, that is assuring people that it came from you by using that public key. Now, that is something that can be applied in a lot of other ways. Actually, let me interject another. This question just popped into my head while we're on this. Would there be any point? Whoa, I just went right in the microphone with that. Sorry about that to the listeners. Would there be any point into having a three-way handoff for the encryption? I mean, let's say, is there any point, for example, you encrypting something with your private key, sending it to me, for whatever reason, as an intermediary, where I then encrypt it with my private key, so it's doubly encrypted, and then send it on so that the receiving person has to have both of our permissions to get...
That's an interesting question. There are protocols that work that way, and it's usually a situation where... and people like to talk about crypto in terms of a cast of characters that are named after the alphabet. You've got Alice, Bob, Carol, Dave, Eric, you know, A, B, C, D, and E. So I'll talk in those terms. Alice and Bob are engaged in a deal of some sort, like maybe on eBay or something. And Alice doesn't trust Bob. Bob doesn't trust Alice. And so they need a third party to sort of be an intermediary for them in general. And we usually call the trusted third party Trent, because it starts with a T. And, you know, in one simple application, the United States Post Office actually does this. You can send your message to, and which you would have maybe digitally signed, you would have encrypted it with your private key. You send the message to the U.S. Postal Service, and they'll encrypt it with their private key, and they'll put a timestamp on it, which demonstrates that that they saw this document at this time. And nobody trusts you when you show up with this document and you say, I wrote this document on, you know, November 1st, 2001. You know, they don't believe you. But, you know, if you get it signed by the United States Post Office, people trust the United States Post Office. And so they will trust you that this document was written when it was supposed to be written.
All right. Now,
does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure about trusting the post office, but okay, yeah, we'll go with it for the example.
Maybe you don't trust the post office, but it doesn't matter who Trent is. You know, that's an example. The U.S. Post Office sells this service because the U.S. Post Office thinks people trust them. anybody could be Trent.
Gotcha. It doesn't matter
of who you trust.
Yeah, I gotcha. And actually, that leads into another question is first of all, these things, now that you're explaining it this way, what springs to mind is like central certification authorities, or what is that? Is that the proper term? Digital?
Okay. Well, when you think about this whole system, for where I put my public key up on MemeStreams, for example, for you to download, you know, what's the problem with this? The problem is that how do you know, especially on the internet, that you're really getting my key? How do you know someone isn't tampering with it? Someone could be, you know, man in the middling your connection to my website and, you know, inserting a different key instead of my key, you know. And actually, like, maybe I should discuss man in the middle, the way man in the middle works. So in sort of an idealistic system, you know, we'll talk about Alice and Bob again. And say Alice and Bob want to do public key encryption for the purpose of privacy. So Alice gets Bob's public key from Bob's website, and Bob gets Alice's public key from Alice's website. And then Alice can encrypt messages to Bob with Bob's public key, and Bob can encrypt messages to Alice with Alice's public key. So let's say you do this. Now, let's say we have this evil player who gets in and mucks stuff up, and her name is usually Mallory, because it starts with an M, and she's in the middle. When Alice tries to get Bob's public key from Bob's website, Mallory fools Alice and presents Mallory's public key instead. And so Alice thinks that she got Bob's public key, but actually she got Mallory's public key. And so when the same thing happens to Bob, when Bob tries to get Alice's public key, he ends up getting Mallory's public key instead of Alice's public key. So when Alice goes to send a message to Bob, instead of, she thinks she's encrypting it with Bob's public key, but she's encrypting it with Mallory's public key. And Mallory intercepts this message, decrypts it, reads it, and then she re-encrypts it with Bob's public key and sends it on to Bob. And Bob gets it, and it's encrypted with his public key so he can decrypt it. And neither of them are the wiser.
Right.
That's kind of a complex thing to explain without a drawing. Does it make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. Nobody knows that that even took place because the person in the middle, the man in the middle, or the woman in the middle in this case, had both of the keys that he or she needs that they would never know she was there based on their correspondence anyway, not without some other mistake.
Right. So that's a big problem with these systems on the Internet. And different tools have different ways of addressing them. Most people who are listening to the show are probably familiar with SSH, and they might have seen what happens, you know, when you SSH to a new computer, or maybe if you SSH to an old address, but the OS has been reinstalled or something, you get this big warning message, and it says, warning, you know, the key identity for this computer has changed. Something bad might be happening. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep, and most people just click right on through it.
That's right. Well, the thing that happens when you use PGP for the first time and you communicate with somebody, or sorry, SSH, you use SSH for the first time and you're communicating with somebody, you do this exchange that I was talking about where you get their public key, they get your public key, and, you know, everything's cool. And you actually store a fingerprint of their public key on your hard drive so that the next time that you connect to them, you can make sure that the key that you're getting is the same one you got the last time. So if you see suddenly that you're trying to connect to them and you're getting a strange key that you don't recognize, it might be that you're not getting Bob's key, you're getting Mallory's key.
Right.
And that's why that message pops up. Now, most people don't understand it.
Right.
So, unfortunately, man-in-the-middle attacks against SSH connections are somewhat successful because users don't know, they don't understand cryptography, and they don't know what's happening when that message pops up, and they just click OK.
I think they do now. I think that is a very, very good example. I think you explained it very well, and I think they absolutely do now. There is a reason that message pops up, and I do think that you made it clear as to why it's important. I absolutely do.
So another way of addressing that problem is with certificate authorities, and that's what VeriSign does. Everyone's pretty familiar with them. To put in my side comment here, I don't like VeriSign because of SiteFinder, and so I really don't like doing business with them. I tend to get my certificates from a company called GeoTrust, mm-hmm. who I have had good experiences with. It's easy to talk about VeriSign because they're much more well-known than GeoTrust is.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do is they act like Trent, the same Trent that was in our post office protocol,
right,
where everyone trusts VeriSign, har har.
So,
if you want, and you can actually get a personal identity certificate from them, where you actually go up there and you say, you know, my name is Snake Dog and da 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 da,
right,
and this is my public key. And VeriSign will digitally sign your public key with their key and give you back this thing called a certificate, which is, you know, your public key signed by their private key. And everyone's got VeriSign's public key. It's in Microsoft Windows. It's in your web browser. Everyone's got it. So if you present your certificate to them, they can verify that VeriSign signed it. And so maybe they trust that your public key really is your public key because VeriSign says it is.
Yeah, but what? Okay, how does where's the communication take place? Like, what if VeriSign got DDoSed? What if VeriSign went off the web? What if their box just exploded?
They don't need to be online when you actually validate the certificate.
They don't,
because you already have VeriSign's public key. And the usually when you're doing certificates, the person who you're communicating with, they will give you their public key wrapped as a certificate. So you get the certificate, and it's got a public key in it, and then it's got this block that's VeriSign saying, you know, this really is StinkDog's public key, and you can validate VeriSign's signature because you've got VeriSign's public key.
Okay. So
does that make sense? So you don't need to send any messages over the network to VeriSign to ask them any questions. They've already. It's sort of like if you've got a piece of paper, and you know, you've got a contract, and you sign the contract, and then somebody witnesses the contract.
Right.
You know, so you've got two signatures on this contract, and then you send it to somebody, and they can verify that that is VeriSign's signature. And so, you know, they don't need to talk to VeriSign in order to do that.
Well, isn't that kind of what I explained earlier in my example where I said, what if, you know, we added a third person? You sent something to me,
yes.
Then I double encrypt it and send it on to the third person. I'm basically vouching
okay.
for that person or something along those lines.
That's exactly right, and that is what VeriSign is doing. They are Trent.
So what is the difference between, I mean, why should I trust VeriSign or this other company you mentioned or any other one? What's to stop, I mean, I could make the StankDog digital certification, I mean...
Yep, you could. Now, what would happen is that if you went to Microsoft and said, I want you to include the public key for StankDog Certificate Authority in Internet Explorer, Microsoft would kindly tell you to go away.
I don't know how kind it would be, but...
there are certain companies that, you know, and a lot of it, I mean, it's complex. Maybe it has to do with reputation capital. VeriSign has done a good job at building up a reputation in the market of being an arbiter of trust on the Internet. And so they, you know, people tend to recognize them. Maybe they would never have heard of StakeDog Certificate Authority.
Right.
So, you know, and then the browser manufacturers, you know, they think about whose public keys they put in their browser, and you know they're not going to put a public key in their browser if they think that the company who manages it is scummy. But at the same time, I'll say two things. First of all, it's really easy to add a new certificate authority into your installation of Microsoft Windows. So maybe
right.
if you and your friends trust the StankDog Certificate Authority
right.
more than they trust Microsoft, they'll take your public key and install it in the OS themselves, and then they'll trust the people that you've certified.
Right, and that's what I was getting ready.
The second thing is that, you know, you get into, you can, there's this great scene in Ghost in the Shell. I think it's, you know, they're in Hong Kong and they're kind of in this garbage truck. They just busted this guy who's like, you know, who's like a puppet of a puppet master. And they're talking about, you know, what's going on. They're trying to figure out what the plan of the puppet master is. And, you know, they're like, well, you know, maybe he did this for this reason. And then they say, well, maybe he just wants us to think that that's what he's doing, but actually he's trying to do this. And then the next guy says, well, maybe he just wants us to think that he wants us to think that. And, you know, it kind of goes, there's layers of paranoia. Well, you can get into layers of paranoia with computer security where you're saying, well, you know, I trust VeriSign, but the problem is that I downloaded my web browser off of Microsoft's website, and I don't know if somebody, Mallory, might have, you know, messed with my download, you know, when I downloaded the browser in the first place. So maybe she put a bad key in my browser for VeriSign, you know.
Right.
There's all these questions, and it gets really, really messy if you want to sort of shore up every single possibility.
Right. But I hate to do this. We're gonna have to cut some of the show. We got maybe 5 minutes. But yeah, I know. It's definitely, some of this is going to have to go till next one. But this has been really good.
We could probably talk about this for 4 hours.
Yeah, this has been really good so far. But let's stay with this and finish at least this part up. So you said kind of what I was getting ready to ask with my next question is, fine, Microsoft doesn't want to support it or build it into their browser or whatever browser doesn't want to. But technically, I could probably write my own app, an open source, open Linux interface, or like you said, I could write some type of plug-in for Internet Explorer or something like that, that as long as those people trusted it and installed it, as an authenticating, new authenticating, I could make StankDog up like that. I mean, of course I don't have any intention, but, you know, theoretically speaking, that authentication, I don't know what the proper term is, but if they installed that plugin to Internet Explorer, it would acknowledge and recognize you as an official certification site just as easily as VeriSign or any of the others.
That's true.
Yeah, just jump right back in because I kept talking.
Wait. There's one other thing that I think I should cover in order to make the topics we've discussed complete.
Go ahead.
PGP has a very interesting way of solving. We talked about how SSH solves this problem, and we talked about how VeriSign and Microsoft solve this problem. Another person who addresses this problem is PGP, and the way they do it is kind of neat because they don't have this sort of idea of a central person that you trust. They don't have Trent. What they have is a web of trust. So, you know, one person has their public key signed by another person, and that other person says, you know, I know this guy, and I met him in person, and I'm sure that this is his public key. And then somebody else signs his key. And maybe, you know, maybe one person's public key might be signed by 10 or 15 different people that they've met in person. And so you can kind of ask this question like, I don't know if this is this guy's public key, but I know, maybe it was you, me, and Alice. You know, you don't know Alice, so you're not sure if Alice's public key is really her public key, but you know me, and you've got my public key, and I've signed Alice's key, so you trust me, and hence you trust Alice. And it kind of works in an unstructured way.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there, but I'm questioning, something pops into my head that now it seems like you've opened yourself up, instead of just being man in the middle between A and B, you're opening up a man in the middle. If any single one person in that web of trust has been compromised, seems like that could really throw a big wrench into that idea.
Well, you're right, but what you hope to have is like maybe 10 or 15 people involved, and if that's the case, then like, you know, if one of them gets compromised, it doesn't ruin everything, because maybe instead of just trusting me that I say that this is Alice's public key, maybe you want 10 people to say this is Alice's public key. And if 10 different people say it, then maybe you'll believe it.
And only if all 10 say it.
Right.
If any one of them was off, then that's a point of something that needs to be looked into or investigated. If one person is off, then you got to find out what that reason is.
Yeah, and in PGP, you know, if you get into setting your trust settings, you can control that to a certain extent. You
All
can
right.
control, like, how many people need to trust this person and whether or not you trust specific people. And there's a lot of features in there for tweaking around with that kind of stuff.
And as we close up here, are those same things also available in GPG? Because PGP is a private, you know, GPG is the open source equivalent. Does the same thing hold true with those?
Now, that's an interesting question. To be honest with you, I don't have a good answer. I'm pretty sure that GPG uses a web of trust model for certifying people, but, you know, I don't, I mean, I've certainly used GPG a lot, but I don't know if, like, to what extent they have those features. I'm pretty sure they have them, but I don't know if they're exactly the same as PGP, or if there are GPG key servers or any of those kinds of questions. So that's an interesting question. I'll have to go check that out.
All right. Well, I do hate to cut this off because there's so much other stuff we can talk about. But, yeah, I'm afraid we're going to have to bump it for another show. I do think this was fantastic. I think we did a great job. You clarified a lot of stuff, I think, in a good way. Again, I know it's difficult on radio. I know a lot of stuff you want to I bet you're over there moving your hands and describing, trying to draw it out within the air, but I think it came across really well. Will you come back on another time maybe soon and talk about some more application, because we talked about how it works, but I like to sit down and say, okay, what about how do we use it for our websites? How do we use it for our email? How do we protect our, you know, some actual stuff like that?
Certainly. I'm always down for BinRev Radio.
Great. Well, Let's shout out then. Let's move into the shout outs and wrap it up here. And why don't you go ahead and go first, because it's been a while since you've been on. Why don't you start off?
Well, I'll just give a shout out to Rattle, and I'll give a shout out to Acidus and to Alonka, who I haven't gotten the opportunity to listen to last week's show, but I'm sure she did an awesome job. She's a really interesting speaker, and she's done some really neat stuff. Shout out to everyone on Meatstreams. What's up?
Yeah, and of course, it's kind of funny, you know, that we. You know, we somewhat run in the same circles, I guess, because we have a lot of the same friends in common there. So definitely all of those people that I have met and were very, very good to me. So I second all that. And just I'll add one more to Rocket. I spoke with Rocket and the guys over at Interzone. We'll give a shout out to them. And Interzone 4 is coming up, and we'll probably talk about that on the show next week. I'll get some information and bring that up then. If you have any email for us on any of the topics tonight, you can email us at radio@benrev.com. And one last pimp, go to MemeStreams, MemeStreams, MemeStreams. Closing music tonight is The Mr. Move. It's called The Dirty Truth. I really like this guy. I've been listening to a lot of this lately. Thanks to Natus for turning me on to this. Very interesting style. And Decius, thank you again for being on, and I'm going to hold you to that. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about a lot of that other stuff we wanted to cover. I mean, boy, it just seems like we're writing books on all these questions that I have about this topic, so there's definitely a lot of material to cover. There's enough for a couple shows, maybe.
So there's enough for a long time, if you're into technology, to sit and study and play with this stuff. It's a whole world to explore.
Yeah, it really is, absolutely. So thank you for being on, and to our listeners, the new listeners on podcast, I hope you enjoy the show. Go back and listen to the old ones, and for our regular listeners, we'll end it the same way we always do, and tell them that we'll see them next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.